everyone. Welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We're having a show on Sunday. As you know, I got locked out on Friday. But the situation has been rectified, crisis averted, and here we are. We'll still have a regular show tomorrow, just a little switcheroo this week. So thank you for your patience and for understanding. Saturday was a tough day. We said goodbye to Dory Monson. It was a lovely memorial. It was really very well attended. I saw a lot of politicians there. There were a lot of listeners there, of course, family and friends. You know, they had a goal of making it a memorial that would be uplifting. And oh my gosh, it was. And thank you to Matt Gilbert for posting photos from the memorial on the Dory Monson memorial page. It was, you know, I love the way they did it because, you know, yes, we heard from his family and his friends and his colleagues, but they also had this segment of it that they had two of his former high school basketball players who spoke about what he meant to them as a mentor, as young women, and then what they learned from him that made them better adults, better professionals later in life. And I, you know, that resonated with me so much as someone who, you know, Dory Monson was a mentor for, you know, from my early 20s until the day he died. And it was an emotional service, but it was so important to be able to say goodbye and to reflect on his memory and just really realize how much he meant to so many people. And so that's what I did yesterday. So grateful to all of you who have continued to reach out with positive thoughts and sentiments. And very hard to say goodbye to Dory in that way. But as was said at the memorial, he was a fisher of men, and his legacy lives on in so many people, the young women he coached in basketball, his daughters, people like me, people like his producer, Nicole Thompson, who learned so much from him. I mean, like 80% of who I am as a professional, you know, who I was as a journalist and now a podcaster, are values I learned from Dory. I'm not talking about political values. I'm talking about work ethic. I'm talking about integrity. I'm talking about, you know, being a fierce advocate for the underdog as Dory was. And I'm so glad I learned those lessons from him as young as I did. And we'll try every day to carry them forth. So, again, just it's so hard to even put that loss into words, but it was important to be able to be there on Saturday and hear about how much he meant to so many people. All right, I want to dive right into an interview I teased on Friday when we were supposed to do the show with Jonathan Cho. So as you know, I published an article last week about how some Democratic politicians in Washington state have been changing some of their internal policies or practices around who they determine is a journalist and who is not, and who gets access to press conferences and who doesn't, who gets email responses and who doesn't. The article, it's on Patreon and Locals. The headline is, "You're not actually a journalist, what happens when the government dictates media access?" And as part of it, you know, I went through hundreds of documents obtained through public disclosure. And I think the result is really an important conversation starter about who gets to decide who the journalists are. The media environment is weird right now. You have, of course, corporate legacy media, but you have more and more independent outlets, independent journalists popping up. I mean, look at me. I left legacy media to do an independent podcast. And you have different funding styles for those independent outlets. My funding style is a mix. Of course, I rely on the generosity of listeners and viewers to support the podcast. And also advertising revenue, like most media outlets do. I also happen to be an ambassador for a politically inclined organization, Future 42, which is something I talk about publicly. They sponsor a Monday segment on the show. And then you have people like Jonathan Cho, who he works for a think tank. He works for Discovery Institute, which is a conservative think tank. But he says he has complete autonomy to do reporting on homelessness for fixhomelessness.org, which is a branch of Discovery Institute. So it does raise important, interesting questions about who gets access to elected officials, who is treated as a journalist by elected officials. And my argument is, I don't think it should be the government. I think that kind of flies in the face of the First Amendment. But Jonathan Cho was nice enough to come in for Fridays with Friends and talk about the revelations in this article. And then also we dove into another really eye-opening story that he's working on about the homelessness crisis and some of these hotels that are being bought up to eventually, in theory, house homeless people. Jonathan Cho, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What's life like for you right now? Because I feel like you're always at a homeless camp in Sweetman something. Do you have a life?
That pretty much sums it up. I do have a family, so, you know, that's always priority. But I also have friends, believe it or not. But, yeah, this is really a calling for me. So I'm out there all the time. And probably after this taping, I'll be heading back out.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. To the extent that you're willing to kind of open up about your private life, you know, you become a very public figure very quickly, beyond, I think, what you were when you were on TV. And, you know,
that's kind of ironic, isn't it?
Isn't that how it works? Yeah, people don't care about TV anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, I try not to, like, use the segue of some people say you're controversial, because I think those people are totally unhinged. But how is that for your family, for your wife? Does it bother her?
She just wants to make sure that the check clears, and as long as the check clears, you know, and I come home and, you know, I do my part at home, then that's all that matters. But yeah, I've put my wife through the ringer just this past year, especially the job transition. And this is really the first time I'm talking about that, you know, because as you can imagine, when you get fired from your full-time job, you know, you're like, what?
Yeah.
And what are you going to do next? So this, you know, opportunity, the media fellowship at Discovery Institute has really been really a blessing in disguise, right? Because in many ways, it's allowed me to really go after these stories that I've always wanted to go after more in depth now. In other words, I've been unleashed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the corporate restraints. I don't have the brand safe restraints. And I can just show, again, the raw realities on the ground. So, you know, I love what I'm doing.
Yeah. And we'll get to more of that restraint issue in a little bit. But, you know, on another note, you know, paychecks and all of that aside, you were, and I'll play the video here, chased by a man with an axe the other day. And so the type of stuff that you're doing, how does that sit with your significant other?
Well, like I said, I don't think she actually watches more than half the stuff I put out there.
Oh, okay.
So that helps. So when I get home, we're just talking about, hey, what's for dinner? Do the bills get paid? So she knows what I do, but she also knows that I'm not stupid and I'm experienced. And, you know, I get myself into these situations. You know, I do a risk assessment every time I go out there. Look, I'm not looking for axe-wielding homeless people, you know, to chase me. You know, yeah. It just happens, right? And I don't want to be in these situations all the time, but I'm always hitting record. And, you know, in many ways, I'm glad I've been able to, again, be in the middle of all of this to show what's really happening on the ground, because these homeless encampments, I mean, it's not only, you know, problematic for the neighborhood, the business owners and neighbors, but the actual homeless themselves, who are ultimately victims and deal with violence and danger all the time on the streets.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, and it's something I feel too, is being unshackled from sort of the corporate media environment and just not worrying. I think for me, I don't think I had to suppress myself a ton in corporate TV.
Yeah.
But I think when you're out of it, you realize how much you held back on certain narratives or didn't even bring stories forth that maybe you would have otherwise. So for you, and this is going to be key to the conversation we're having today, now you are working for a think tank, Discovery Institute, but
sure.
You're a senior fellow for fixhomelessness.org. Do you feel restrained in a different kind of way because of who you work for?
Well, let me just qualify all of that by saying, yes, I knew what I was getting myself into, quote unquote, the realities of working for or being associated with a conservative think tank. But I made it very clear when they offered me this media fellowship for 1 year, again, that I would have full autonomy, that I would be able to chase all of these stories objectively, fairly, and accurately without any agenda. So when I got the green light to do that, I said, I'm all in.
Yeah.
So I want to be very clear about that. I understand, you know, guilt by association, and my critics will always come up with something. But I'm a journalist through and through, 20 plus years in this business in television news, working for all the network affiliates and multiple top 10 media markets like Chicago, Minneapolis, my hometown of Boston, and now Seattle. So I have nothing to be ashamed of. I'm just going to continue to be a journalist. That's part of who I am, and it's my calling.
So you, of course, saw the article that I published this past week. The headline, "You're not actually a journalist. What happens when the government dictates media access?" In transparency, you knew I was working on this story behind the scenes because I'd also reached out to you to get some emails that you'd sent back and forth with some of these offices. But just you didn't know that what the story was going to really detail.
So, I had no clue.
Yeah. So on first read, I mean, how does it hit you to know sort of and to see some of the conversations happening behind the scenes about how you were going to be dealt with or what kind of access was going to be given to you?
Well, first of all, now I know why I wasn't getting phone calls or emails returned and why these RSVP media press conference, emails weren't coming into my inbox any longer. I've had a few days now to process your incredible deep dive bombshell investigation. Really disappointing, mm-hmm. I'd say. These are our elected officials who talk about the importance of transparency and, being open to the public, and then to ice me out, essentially, because, clearly I'm asking questions that bring up some inconvenient truths, and it's evident they don't like that. But my job as a journalist every single day is to ask these very questions on behalf of the community and to hold our public officials accountable. And look, my videos that I'm getting, my stories I'm getting on the ground, you're not going to see that on mainstream television news or in a local newspaper. So I think a lot of these elected officials aren't prepared to deal with these raw realities that I'm bringing to them. So I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. I want them to, process it. But at a certain point, you've got to answer for what's happening on the ground, what your policies ultimately are leading to or not leading to. And that's ultimately all I'm trying to figure out. And I'm hoping at some point they recognize, again, who I am as a journalist, my entire body of work. I don't have an agenda except getting to the truth and trying to understand what they're going to do about these issues and problems that are evident in the community, especially when it comes to the homelessness and drug addiction crisis.
One of the things that was clearly a theme in the emails, many of which, weren't published. I kind of picked out some that really told a story, but you'd reach out about something and, the county would give the boilerplate response of, "We declined to participate in your project." But then behind the scenes, they'd say, "Well, if he's going to cover it, other media outlets are going to pick it up essentially. And so we need to get our talking points together anyway." So to know that, your reporting was leading to other media coverage that then they would respond to, how does that sit with you?
Well, first of all, it kind of affirmed that my work and the story I was working on was newsworthy, mm-hmm. And impactful, and it got the attention of elected officials. I mean, bottom line, I think your listeners and your audience need to know that it's evident now everyone in Washington State, when it comes to at least elected officials, are aware of what we're doing at Discovery Institute and what I'm doing online on social media, especially on Twitter. So that's kind of cool to know that my work is having an impact. But at the same time, to be honest with you, it's extremely frustrating, right? Because all I want to do is get their perspective, their side of the story. I'm trying to be fair. But at the same time, it makes my job easier then, right? Because in journalism, we have a big scoop. If it's controversial, if it involves an elected official or a leader, we go to them and try to find out, is this true? Is this really what is happening? You've been accused of X, Y, and Z. Would you like to respond? And if they don't, we say that, hey, we try to reach out to this person and this person chose not to respond or declined to respond. You know, at the end of the day, it makes the politician look bad, mm-hmm. when they don't respond. It's almost like, what are you hiding?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and I should also point out that there are a ton of politicians that are still actively participating in your stories. There's a story I'm going to play in a little bit that was really fascinating that came out, a great investigative piece. And you had, I swear to God, every politician in Federal Way was part of your story.
Yeah.
And so when I see what's happened to you with other offices, I can't help but realize that it's the most highly ideological ones, like King County Executive Dow Constantine, who has these lofty dreams of being governor. It's the governor's office. So for you, I guess, why do you think you have some politicians who are Democrats,
yeah.
who are so willing to participate, and then you have these other ones who are absolutely not, he works for a think tank?
Well, to answer the first part of your question, I think, for example, in Federal Way, I think a lot of these local elected officials are starting to realize their communities are not being covered by the mainstream local media, first of all. Federal Way literally only has one online paper called the Federal Way Mirror, okay? And you can't expect one small paper, with all due respect to the Federal Way Mirror, to cover the entire community, because Federal Way is huge. So I think they appreciated that, first of all, that I would bring attention and light to a serious issue. Yet at the same time, I think it's evident some of the bigger offices that you exposed in your piece, like the governor's office, King County Executive Dow Constantine's office, yeah, at the end of the day, they clearly have an agenda. They have their talking points. And I think, again, a lot of your listeners and viewers may not realize that they have robust PR and media teams. And they have outgunned local journalists.
Yeah, and who we pay, by the way.
Yeah, and their mission every single day is to control the narrative, right? They only want certain stories out. When there's a ribbon-cutting ceremony or a groundbreaking, that's the only time they want media to come out to cover those events. But when it comes to, again, inconvenient truths, they don't want to deal with that. And I think, arguably, I'm one of the few journalists left in this community right now asking a lot of these tough questions. And let me be very clear. My email and DMs are just full of questions from constituents of, you know, Dow Constantine and Governor Jay Inslee begging me to ask these questions or look into these stories. So all I'm doing is, again, my job as a journalist is to be an extension and a voice for the community.
Yeah, and you've grown such a big following in such a short period of time, relatively speaking. I mean, you haven't been a reporter in Seattle for a very long time. What is it, like three years now?
Yeah, a little less than 3 years.
Yeah, and so to me, I think there's almost this also unwillingness to keep up with the times and to say, you know, oh, well, if the mainstream, you know, we're working with this newspaper or this blog, this TV station, and they do cover the homeless issues, but they do it in like a minute and 45 seconds on the evening news amidst a bunch of other stories. And I would argue that more people are seeing what you're doing on social media.
Yeah, and it's also because the people on social media who are following me, they're the ones tipping me off to the stories that are actually happening in their communities, on the ground in their neighborhoods. So I think a lot of people in this region, in the Pacific Northwest, who are dealing with the homelessness crisis and who've been impacted directly, they're looking at what's being covered on the local news, and they're like, wait a second, that's not what's actually happening.
Right.
Here's what's actually happening. And they know what I'm going to put out there is unfiltered. Again, what's actually happening on the ground. So I think I'm building trust, credibility with a lot of these neighbors, and they're coming to me first now. So I appreciate that, and I will do my best to continue to cover these community. It really is a big responsibility, but at the same time, a privilege.
Yeah, and the way you're putting information out there is really interesting, too, because a lot of it, like you said, is unfiltered. It'll be just a raw clip of what's happening as opposed to sort of a chopped-up narrative, which never tells the full story. You know, like, for instance, you getting chased with an axe, and you put that video out there of the whole encounter.
Yeah.
I think a lot of reporters would have just left that and not put it up and not even included it in their story, or if they did, a little snippet.
Right.
And so it gives a much fuller picture. I want to take a moment to give credit to a few other news organizations that have tried to help you out during this whole debacle. You know, as I say in the story, you texted me end of the summer, I think, and saying, hey, I'm being iced out. Are you getting press releases? Can you forward them to me? And when, for instance, the governor's office and others said, no, you work for a think tank, you don't work for a media organization, other media organizations did reach out to you to offer you credentials, right, to try to help you be, quote unquote, legitimate in the eyes of these politicians. What are some of the local and also one national or two national that reached out and said, hey, we want to make sure you get access?
Yeah, that's a huge part of the story. And I just want to thank some of the local papers. Linwood Times, the Mill Creek View, both offered me media credentials. And what they've continued to do is just forward me the RSVPs and the locations of these press conferences. So I hope I'm not outing them. And, you know,
but
at this point, we'll know why if they stop getting it. You know, these info mailers from the governor's office or King County, but also some of the national players like, you know, the Daily Wire. post-millennial. They've all offered me media credentials. And I've, you know, had the National Review. Also, John Fund, he's one of the columnists there, heard about what was happening to me and said, I can easily get you a credential. Mm-hmm. I'd love to get you a credential. Yet, this is the kicker. I presented this to the governor's press team, and they still rejected me.
It wasn't enough. And not only that, they then changed the reason why they weren't going to let you go to a governor's press conference. It was, at first, it was, nope, you work for a think tank.
Yep.
So you said, hey, here's this. I think in that instance, it was the Mill Creek View, right?
Yeah.
You said, hey, I have this local paper. They're going to send me there. They have a credential. And that's when they changed it to, well, your social media behavior isn't in line, isn't in keeping with our standards. If it was just the think tank issue and they drew a bright line, like they've said, I think reasonable people could agree to disagree on that.
Sure.
You know, because you got to draw the line somewhere. I get it. Politically affiliated or leaning organization, fine. But when they brought social media into it, that's when I knew we kind of had them. Because as I pointed out in the article, you know, they instituted this policy, this integrity policy. They said, quote, as public employees working in a highly visible public office, we hold ourselves to the highest professional and ethical standards. We hold anyone who purports to be a journalist to the same standards. And then, as I point out, Mike Falk, who's the deputy communications director, his social media is terrible. He, you know, has gone after Jason Rance, who's a bona fide member of the media, and he told the Republican governor of Missouri to eat shit. I mean, you've said a lot of things on Twitter, as have I, but I don't think either of us have ever told a politician to eat shit.
Yeah, and for the record, I've never used curse words on social media, and I'm trying to keep to that.
Yeah, but it just shows that you're saying that you're holding journalists to a high ethical standard for their behavior on social media, yet you're not even following those standards.
Yeah, and, you know, that particular instance, you know, again, when I got that email response from Jamie Smith, another member of Governor Inslee's media team, calling me out for essentially defending myself against local blogger Erica Barnett.
Who is a frequent, she's attacked me many times, and people are always like, oh, you're getting dust-ups. I said, you try to find one instance where I instigated it.
Exactly.
All we've ever done is defend ourselves against some crazy, crazy narratives about right wing, you know, just lunatic stuff.
Right. And I don't want to use this time to, you know, give credence to Erica Barnett. But let me just tell you, she started attacking me even during my time at Como News.
Right.
And when I was at Como, I had strict corporate policies where I couldn't respond to anything. Right.
Right.
So I never did. But the moment I went to Discovery Institute, I became independent. And that's when I said, enough is enough. This woman is absolutely unhinged. And I started calling her out and pulling out inconvenient truths. And there was even an instance where she lied about, you know, things that I allegedly said during a press conference. And I record everything, as you know. And I responded and said, no, actually, this is what happened. Mm-hmm. And Barnett had nothing to say. And, you know, several ensuing, you know, exchanges after that, Erica Barnett actually blocked me now.
Yeah.
Right. So I can't even respond to her insanity. But Jamie Smith, again, at the governor's office, decided to point that out. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, she said that your treatment of Erica Barnett was one of the reasons that even with a press credential from the Mill Creek View, you weren't going to be allowed to go to the president, the governor's press conference. I will tell you, I got a response from Jamie because I asked her specifically, if you're saying that his social media behavior is not, you know, up with standards, what about these examples of Erica Barnett's social media behavior? You know, she's verbally she's insulted people who listen to my show,
right,
called them very condescending names. She was sued by two media personalities in town for lying about them in an article.
And she's been arrested, by the way, for shoplifting.
Well,
I'm
not going to bring that up.
That's, okay, I will. But
yeah,
anyway.
I mean, alcoholism is a serious thing, and I don't want to make light of that. I'm looking more at her behavior on social media,
sure.
And so I had asked the governor's office, well, if Jonathan's behavior is so bad, would you allow Erica Barnett at a press conference? Because here are examples of her being atrocious on social media. And the response I got was, well, she hasn't asked, and we would evaluate that if she does ask. But of course, she's not going to go down and cover anything at the governor's office.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm glad that you gave a shout out to some of those media organizations that helped you out. as you kind of move forward and you know now what's happening behind the scenes and how they're approaching you, does it change anything for you about, do you just stop reaching out to those offices and just go on your own? And what do you do?
Well, first and foremost, I have to stick to my, you know, standard news gathering, you know, principles. And that's always to, you know, get the other side of the story, right? So I'm always going to reach out to a public official if they're part of the story. And whether or not they want to engage or respond, that's going to be up to them. Now, when it comes to press conferences, clearly the governor has said, I'm no longer invited. Mm-hmm. Dow Constantine speaks for itself. I'm not invited to any of his either. But Mayor Bruce Harrell, it's really interesting. While I don't get RSVPs to any more of the press conferences from his office, I haven't officially been blocked. And I actually recently, just last month, attended a press conference and was able to get in a question. And, you know, credit Mayor Bruce Harrell. He's always answered my question. So I think I still have a good rapport personally with Mayor Bruce Harrell. So bottom line, these are all public officials. If they're out in the wild, you know, if they're out in the streets, you know, they're fair game. Yeah. Now, I have a policy. If they're having dinner with their family, you know, I'm not going to go and, you know, ambush them. Correct. I'm also not going to knock on their doors, you know, at their personal address, okay? But if they're out at a ribbon cutting, if they're, you know, at the mall with, you know, doing a photo op, if I see them and I got a question, I'm going to ask them. So I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah. I asked my viewers on Wednesday's show to answer the question of where should the line be drawn?
Yeah.
How do we, because I've expressed this to you before, it can't be a free-for-all at a press conference. The people who are there to gather information need to be able to do that without it becoming a circus. So I asked folks, you know, and I'm going to read some of your guys' comments at the end of the show. Where do you think the line should be drawn for who gets access to these events and who should draw that line? Should it be politicians? For you, what would you like to see? This big changing media environment.
Yeah.
You do have people getting funding from outside sources, some of them politically aligned. What do you think the line should be and who gets to decide that line?
I mean, like you said, this is evolving. I'd be curious to see where this all, you know, shakes out, you know, when the dust clears. But I think first and foremost, if you do this full time for a living, you're a journalist, bottom line, right? There are a lot of bloggers out there who could be working, you know, at a Starbucks full time and then blog at night. I mean, I guess on a case-by-case basis, you're going to have to evaluate those situations. But bottom line, if you do this full-time for a living, I think you should be getting access. Number two, look at that journalist's entire body of work. Out of almost anybody right now in Seattle or King County or, you know, Washington State's media corps, I have 20-plus years experience as a journalist. That's got to be worth something, right?
Yeah.
And then on top of that, how about these third-party media groups, organizations, right? You know, like the Asian American Journalists Association, the National Association of Black Journalists. I'm totally recognized by them. I'm part of these groups, right? They say I'm a journalist, so why does a politician suddenly decide to say I'm not, right? So I think I'm hoping in the coming year that there's at least a third-party maybe group that gets established that can almost be a clearinghouse. You know, I'm just kind of spitballing, you know, stream of consciousness right now, but I think that would be one of the fairest ways, right? And not just giving these local politicians or elected officials all the power to determine who's a journalist, who gets in, who doesn't.
Yeah, almost like the Washington Coalition for Open Government or something. And I'm working on, as you know, a follow-up piece about, with some of these industry groups in the media, about this issue. Because frankly, you know, I had a really brief just chat with the Capitol Correspondents Association, and they're also trying to figure out, they're also trying to work through, because I even asked them, you know, under these rules, what would I be allowed in? And these are people I've worked with for years, who I've covered stories in Olympia with side by side for years and years, and they even struggle with the question of would I be allowed to get a press credential for the day because I am an ambassador for Future 42, which is a political organization. But, you know, it's just really fascinating. And I'm not saying I even have the right answer. I don't even know if I have the right answer for where the line should be. I want to talk quickly about a story that you put down that's it's so good.
Thanks.
And I quote tweeted it and said, but you're not a journalist, Jonathan. Because
I just saw that, by the way.
It's clearly journalism. I'm going to play the whole video, and it's actually a joint investigation between you and Ari Hoffman, our friend over at KVI. So just give a setup for us.
Yeah, so we started asking questions and started really looking into this story a few weeks ago when it was announced that the Stevenson Motel in Federal Way would potentially be converted into a homeless hotel. This motel is right next to a strip mall. Vast majority of businesses there, Korean immigrant owned. They had no idea this was happening. Many of them don't even speak English. Hmm. So, you know, we started to ask, why is this Stevenson Motel being converted potentially into a homeless hotel when the county purchased the Red Lion in Federal Way, the former Red Lion, several years ago, back in 2021? What's the holdup? And that's when the story started to really start unfolding. Some of our sources sent us internal documents showing that the delay was related to methamphetamine, high levels of methamphetamine inside the rooms, and that was the primary reason for these delays.
All right, let's play this story for folks.
The former Red Lion Hotel is conveniently located off Interstate 5. It's easy access to stores and public transportation. That's one of the reasons why King County bought the place for almost $9 million to house the homeless. Problem is, after nearly 2 years, it's still not open.
No, they didn't tell us a thing. We have no idea.
Even city council members say they don't know why.
And then they're not telling us why? There's problems with that.
In a joint investigation with KVI Radio's Ari Hoffman, we started asking questions.
Well, they're hiding, obviously. They're hiding what they're doing.
Initially, King County spokesperson Chase Gallagher said he's declining to participate in the story. That is until we discovered an internal email chain saying the opening of the homeless hotel is delayed because the rooms are contaminated with high levels of methamphetamine. It's unclear exactly how much of this toxic drug was found on the grounds or how it got there, but the levels were dangerous enough to trigger a warning from King County officials, instructing local firefighters to proceed with caution if they have to enter.
Can they go about remediation or repair, or is the building a complete loss?
Federal Way Mayor Jim Farrell says he's disappointed with King County for leaving them in the dark.
The first I'd ever heard about that notification of South County Fire is from you, and so it would have been nice to have received that information.
That's because Farrell says this delay has had a ripple effect.
We were really relying and hoping that that would get online, especially as it got cold.
Aside from the homeless unable to get off the streets, the King County Regional Homelessness Authority and Catholic Community Services are now trying to convert the Stevenson Motel into a temporary shelter until the meth is cleaned up at the former Red Lion.
And at least the businesses should have known about it earlier.
But every business next door is opposed to the plan.
I don't believe that it's something that will help the community.
Sandy Shim works for the strip mall's landlord and says most of these shops and restaurants are Korean immigrant owned.
She didn't know about it.
She's been translating the bad news for her tenants. Pastor Charles Mwangi leads the African church in this strip mall and is also concerned the motel will attract drug use and crime if the homeless move in next door.
We are concerned because we have vulnerable people here.
And wonders if King County is considering the children in his Sunday school.
I know there might be a possibility of maybe having even sex offenders.
So he's also signed the petition with hundreds of signatures and is planning to possibly protest.
South King County is basically the dumpster for Seattle.
Meanwhile, City Council member Erica Norton says King County is holding them hostage because even if Federal Way rejected the permit application, the city would lose grant funding.
I'm willing to say no, this isn't okay.
But bottom line, Washington state law says the county ultimately has final say on turning properties into homeless motels and is not required to ask communities for permission.
Then why do they need the public participation?
In downtown Seattle.
Which is why King County Executive Dow Constantine's been on a motel buying spree across the region.
They've done this to other cities too.
Farrell says he plans on presenting all public input to the county. And if people are caught using drugs on site, the city still can pull the license to operate.
We're put in a position that is really unfair to us.
Regardless, Deputy Mayor Susan Honda says this should be a wake-up call for Federal Way and other cities in the state.
Cities need local control. We know what works best for our city, better than someone in Olympia or someone in Seattle.
As for the county, we brought these findings and community concerns back to Gallagher. He finally acknowledged the meth inside the former Red Lion and says the county spent more than $500,000 to clean up the mess, but still won't say when it will officially open or even if it can be salvaged.
So obviously you reached out to the county as part of this, and I know where this whole interview is about the county not responding. Initially, did they participate? They did not, as you said in that story.
No, it's really interesting, and this is just kind of journalism 101. Like I said, you've got to give the county or state officials an opportunity always to respond. Chase Gallagher, Dow Constantine's main media handler in King County, initially responded with his usual boilerplate. We're choosing not to participate in your project, Jonathan. But again, the moment we got the goods with the methamphetamine, in the walls, the document showing that the county actually warned firefighters that in the event they had to enter, they needed to be extremely careful. And when we brought those documents to Chase, that's when he finally decided to respond. Because how do you not respond to something like that?
Yeah, and I think what's really telling is, again, it's not you and Ari painting some sort of narrative, making a big deal out of it when it's not. They told firefighters it was so severe that you had to be careful. And you have all these other elected officials who, it's their frustration. They're frustrated.
Because they didn't know either.
Right, they're totally kept out of the loop.
For the record, Mayor Jim Farrell in Federal Way says he was extremely frustrated. I was the first journalist to tell him about
this. Yeah, he says that new. I found out about it from you, but you're not a journalist, John.
Yeah, I'm not a journalist, so I guess that doesn't count. But not only the mayor, but the entire city council not knowing what's going on. And I think Deputy Mayor Susan Honda brought it up, and she said it best. What's happening right now in Washington State is that these local officials, these local jurisdictions, are losing power to state lawmakers. And that's a story we all need to be watching very carefully. That's because that same debate is happening right now in the current session.
Yeah, there's a ton of takeaways from the story, even if you don't live in Federal Way. Yeah. It's this, King County has been buying up hotels everywhere to put the homeless. This is just shows how that can really be problematic for some of these communities who feel like they have no say in the issue, who want. I look at it similar to the encampments that pop up on state property. Like you've covered a lot about the one in Spokane that was this massive homeless encampment. In Spokane, they have the political will to remove that thing, but they couldn't because it was on state property.
That's right.
And so it's this interesting dilemma for jurisdictions where it's like this issue is clearly having an impact on our city, on our residents, but we're helpless to have any decision-making over it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of just the average Washington citizen is totally unaware of HB 1220, which is the bill that essentially says that any property that's zoned to be a motel or hotel can be converted at any time to a homeless hotel. So this goes back to a lot of these jurisdictions, local jurisdictions, completely unaware until it happens to them. And that's why King County knows what the law is on the books. All they're doing is simply following the laws. And the law says that they do not need to ask any local jurisdiction, any city or town, for permission to set up a homeless hotel. So look, even Mayor Farrell said it best, and so did all the city council members. If you don't like what's going on, vote. Yeah. Vote accordingly.
You, more than anyone, are right there in talking to people living on the streets, talking to people dealing with addiction, dealing with these agencies that are tasked with fixing the situation. Mm-hmm. Is it getting any better?
Depends how you define better. I feel like what's happening right now is that these agencies, unfortunately, have become bureaucracies. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of red tape. And these agencies are still not working together. They're still not talking to each other properly. They're jurisdictional issues. Brandy, if I could plug, my next big story
Please.
Is how the city of Seattle right now, Mayor Bruce Harrell, I mean, look, at the end of the day, he's a fine, politician in the sense where he'll say he's not going to criticize anyone publicly. But, we have sources saying that he's extremely frustrated with WashDOT, especially all the homeless encampments that are on right-of-ways right now in the city of Seattle, because those problems on the right-of-ways are spilling into the city.
Right.
But Mayor Harrell can't deploy his team to remove any of those because those are on WashDOT property. So that's something to watch again, these jurisdictional issues and how local, cities and work with the state now, and whether or not that's going to change. But clearly, they haven't figured any of this out.
Yeah, I mean, the Ship Canal Bridge encampment, somebody was shot there last week, right? There was a murder?
Yeah, well, someone was shot.
We don't know if they died.
We don't know if it was a homicide or not. The person did die.
Yeah.
But, you know, SPD hasn't officially ruled it a murder or a homicide. But, I mean, the bottom line, that isn't the first shooting. And there have been numerous fires. And this encampment's been there for more than a year. And it's in the Wallingford neighborhood. And there's another one on the other side in the University District, right? So it's just out of control. And neighbors are wondering, who's in charge? Yeah. That's the question. Think about the frustration, you know? Who's in charge? Who's going to enforce? Right now, nobody. Yeah. It's all about pointing fingers.
Yeah, that's the thing. It allows them to, the jurisdictional issues. It allows them to point fingers. It allows them to get off the hook. So I appreciate you, Jonathan, for not letting them get off the hook. And when can we expect that story on the governor or on the mayor and the state?
I'm trying to drop that story this coming week.
Gotcha.
So we'll see. I'll definitely keep you updated.
And where can people follow your work?
A lot of different platforms now, but the primary is fixhomelessness.org. But of course, Twitter, at Chosho, C-H-O-E-S-H-O-W. And I'm expanding to a bunch of different social media platforms and always in the process of creating new partnerships with other media groups here. So we'll see what happens.
Awesome. Jonathan Cho, thanks for joining us for Fridays with Friends. Nice to have you in studio. And people don't know the drama that ensued with trying to make this interview happen.
We made it happen.
Oh, my God. I got locked out. And then it was a mess. You were a very patient man. I appreciate you.
Thank you again for always amplifying this work.
Always great to hear from Jonathan Cho. And I mean, that story we just played of his is a prime example of stories he's doing. And that one was a joint investigation with Ari Hoffman, that the legacy media isn't doing. And I don't think that's always for nefarious reasons. I think some of it is bandwidth. Legacy newsrooms are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And what happens when there aren't enough reporters in those legacy newsrooms to be tackling some of these hyper-local stories? They're just going to go uncovered. You need independent outlets to be able to cover those really important things. And that's why, you know, to shut Jonathan out, given the important work he's clearly doing, you know, he'll do a story and then all of a sudden legacy media will be like, oh, we should do that too. To shut him out, to me, it isn't in the best interest of the public. And maybe that's why politicians are shutting him out, because they don't want the public to see some of these stories. I am now back on round two of the East Side Weight Loss Clinic plan. I'm down 2 pounds since I started at the beginning of the week. My goal is to lose another 13, so the remaining COVID weight, say goodbye to it, and then never say hello to it again. I was at an event earlier this week. A woman who had seen that I was doing the East Side Weight Loss Clinic plan, she came up to me, she's like, hey, you know, tell me about it. Do you think I'd like it? And I said, look, if you're someone who gained some weight recently and you want to lose it quickly, like this is weight that your body is never used to hanging on to, then I think this is a good plan for you. Because that's what I really enjoyed about it, is the quick weight loss. I mean, within the first month and a half, I'd lost 25 pounds. And in fact, at the event in Lewis County, I was wearing a dress that I remember wearing back in November that was like suffocating to me. Like, could barely zip it up. I just felt really gross in it because it was like so tight. And I wore it this past week and it felt great. And so those are the kind of wins that you start to realize. And on the East Side Weight Loss Clinic plan, you realize those wins so, so quickly that there's a lot of motivation to continue to go. No prepackaged meals, no going into an office to be weighed every week, unless you want to, I guess. And you have a handy app on your phone every single day where you can log in, where you can get help if you need to, where you have the plan right at your fingertips. So if you've been holding on to some extra weight, maybe like me, it's COVID weight, and you just want to say goodbye to it, I promise you, if you follow the plan, you will lose weight. So if you're good at structure, just treat it like a job. If you follow the plan, you absolutely will lose weight. There's no way that you can't. So give Dr. Coogan a call, 425-354-3020, 425-354-3020, or you can schedule a free consultation at eastsideweightlossclinic.com. That's eastsideweightlossclinic.com. Tell them you heard about them on the Undivided podcast. All right, a couple WTF stories I want to talk about before we get to your comments on the Jonathan Cho saga. One of them, I just had to, oh my gosh, I laughed so hard at this. And it just speaks to almost like a generation of politicians who are in it for the wrong reasons. And so you remember Lorena Gonzalez? Lorena Gonzalez was an uber progressive councilwoman in Seattle. She then ran for mayor. Thankfully, she lost because she had supported police defunding and all of this. I remember this crazy interview I did with her where I asked her if Amazon was a net good for the city, like tens of thousands of jobs. And she said no. And I'm just like, wow, thank God you didn't become the mayor of Seattle, because that would have become very, very problematic very quickly. But anyway, she sends out this tweet. She's now with the ACLU of Washington. She sent out this tweet that I just died. It said, today, a state lawmaker spelt my name Lorena Gonzalez. So he spelt her first name wrong. I guess he's never heard of me. So a couple things here. First of all, why should he have heard of you? And second, are you really that self-absorbed? It's this lack of humility that I see in so many politicians and political figures these days. Like, oh my gosh, somebody spelt my name wrong. Has he really never heard of me? Yeah, he probably has not heard of you. I don't know if this was meant to be like, oh, I'm, you know, Hispanic and he spelt my name wrong and that's racist because he spelt Lorena like a white woman instead of like a Hispanic woman. But it's just that I guess he's never heard of me. That is just so, oh my God, it's so indicative of I think how a lot of politicians these days feel about themselves. Like I said, no humility. And then she sort of doubled down on this. So a few people shared that, like, wow, this woman is really full of herself. I mean, it's not like you were the president of the United States. You were a Seattle City Council member. And so people also pointed out that she used the wrong version of spelt. So, of course, you would say a state lawmaker spelled my name wrong. And she wrote spelt, which I've learned is actually the word for, I had to Google it, I didn't know, wheat or hulled wheat. So it's a species of wheat, apparently. So anyway, some people were pointing that out, that she's complaining that a state lawmaker spelt her name wrong and she didn't even use the correct version of spelt, which to me isn't a big deal. I spell stuff wrong all the time. And I spell stuff wrong on accident all the time or use the wrong word. Not a big deal. The issue is she like doubled down on it, and it's even something so insignificant, politicians automatically go to gaslighting. So she goes, she's responding to all this criticism, Speltgate 2023, I'm here for it. Never in a million years did I think that the use of a UK-based spelling of a word in a tweet would fire up the right-wing factions on Twitter. Sadly, hilarious. So now, instead of just saying like, oh, you got me, I spelled that word wrong, my bad. Instead of doing that, she claims that she was using the UK version of spelled. Are you British? Councilwoman, last I checked, you're not British. And you don't use any other sort of British words. But spelt is definitely, you definitely intended to use the word spelt from the UK version of English as opposed to spelled. So it's like, you can't even, you lack so much humility. You can't even just sort of laugh at yourself and be like, oh, my bad, I'm going to take the L on that one. No, you have to gaslight people into thinking that you intended to use the UK-based version of spelled and are saying that it's a silly thing that got the right-wing factions of Twitter all riled up. No, you are gaslighting people for no reason. For no reason, just because you used the wrong word and you have no humility and you can't just acknowledge like, oh yeah, that was embarrassing. So I got a text about this from a state lawmaker. I won't say who it is, but they wrote, sometimes I wish people would just shut the F up and do the work. We'd all be better off. I could not have said it better myself. Okay, one more story that popped on my radar that also had me laughing this week. Remember we did the big, long piece, it was an op-ed I published on Patreon and Locals, about how the data being used by some Democrats in Olympia to justify not fixing the police pursuit policy was debunked by a Seattle U professor. So essentially, Senator Monica Dingra, who chairs Law and Justice, you'll recall she's been saying over and over that the pursuit law has led to a 73% reduction in people killed during police pursuits. And she cited this study done by a former University of Washington professor. And there was an independent review of that study done by a professor at Seattle U who's like, this data is essentially meaningless. This study is crude. It should never have been published. It wouldn't have been published in anything peer-reviewed. And lawmakers certainly should not be using it as the basis for any policymaking. Well, after that came out and the data was just debunked, Senator Manka Dingra stood behind it, like didn't even care that people were like, this data is meaningless. I'm going to use it anyway. So then all of a sudden this week, that study that she'd been using and referring to over and over disappeared. It was taken down the website by the website that had been hosting it. Somebody took the study down and it was like, oh my God, this study is so bad. Somebody removed it. And then I think the next day it popped back up. It came back up on the site that it had been for some time and the data was changed. And it went from being a 73% reduction to now a 67% reduction. And here's the issue. And this is one of the issues that the Seattle U professor pointed out with this data set. The numbers on people being killed from police pursuits or during police pursuits, there is no official database for that. So essentially the data they're using is kind of crowdsourced from various sources. And so what the Seattle U professor said is, you know, that data isn't even necessarily reliable. And that's what we're seeing here is they had to acknowledge that the data that they had used to come to that 73% figure had changed. So essentially, before the article, before the study was taken down, they said 11 people were killed during police pursuits in the year and a half before the new law went to effect. And then 3 had been killed in the year and a half after. But now they had to acknowledge that 9 people were killed in the year and a half before the police pursuit law took effect. So since we're talking about numbers that aren't, you know, hugely different anyway, it went from 11 versus 3 to 9 versus 3. So it went from a 73% reduction to a 67% reduction. But now it's like, we've already talked about this data being debunked. Now they've changed it significantly themselves. Are you really going to still continue to rely on this study, this clearly flawed study, to justify not changing the police pursuit policy? And I've seen some people on social media defending it, saying, well, that's why we just need to continue to study this issue. We can't change it. We need to instead create a 19-person commission that can study this issue until 2024. And then for sure, we'll know we have the right data. So let me get this straight. If you're Senator Manka Dingra, you believed this data was so accurate that you were using it as the sole reason to justify not changing the law. You stuck to this data even after it was debunked. You've stuck to this data even after it was taken down, put back up in a changed form. And now you want us to believe that if we just give you a little more time to study it, that you'll come back to us with good data when you've clearly shown a willingness to rely on bad data. No. No more studying it, no more panels, none of that bullshit. You can collect data, sure, but in the meantime, the law needs to be put back the way it was, pre-2021. Because we know for sure, the one figure that is undeniable is there has been a huge spike in the number of people who have fled from law enforcement. That's the only data that we now know to be true, because the data that you have here on number of deaths, we don't know if any of this is even within the realm of reality. So I guess for Senator Manka Dingra, I'm having a hard time understanding whether you actually care about data, facts, and statistics, or whether you care about data, facts, and statistics that back up the argument that you're already trying to make. Okay, I told you guys on the Wednesday show, I wanted you to weigh in on who gets to decide who the journalists are. Should it be the government? Should it be some sort of outside entity? Should it just be a free-for-all where anyone can show up for a press conference at the governor's office? So a few of your thoughts. J&S Adkins on Patreon wrote, regarding where the line should be drawn for who's a journalist, I wonder how badly it would work out if all the press conferences were first come, first served based on the capacity of the space. It does seem inappropriate for the government to be responsible for determining who gets to report on the government. I feel like it should be that until you prove you shouldn't be in a press conference due to inappropriate behavior, anyone can join those press conferences. So one of my issues with first come, first serve is it's kind of like problems we ran into at Seattle City Council meetings, where Shama Sawant would make sure all of her supporters could get there early. I mean, these meetings are in the middle of the day. And then there would be almost no room left on the speaking agenda or capacity in the room for dissent. And that became very, very dangerous. So I don't think I like the idea of first come, first serve based on capacity. I do think that could be a slippery slope. I do agree with you, though, that Jonathan Cho hasn't done anything in press conferences to show that he shouldn't be there. I mean, the one ordeal he had in a press conference where people might point to is he chased after Dow Constantine and chased him down an elevator, but Dow Constantine wouldn't answer his questions. In that setting, had Dow Constantine just took Jonathan Cho's very reasonable questions, it wouldn't have turned into a debacle. So I blame Dow Constantine for turning it into a circus. I totally agree with your sentiment that I think if you work as a journalist, whether it's independent or corporate, if you haven't done anything to show that you can't just be there and ask questions and, you know, behave yourself, then I don't understand why you would be preemptively barred. Let's see. Jill wrote, since everyone wears their political party on their sleeve and most don't report without a slant, I think the credentials should require an equal amount of Republican, Democrat, and independent journalists. They just need to admit who they are and quit hiding behind a journalist's curtain. If only. We all have biases. You're just not supposed to put those biases forward when you're a journalist. So, Alicia wrote, to answer the question that you asked, it's a simple answer. All that needs to be asked is, are you now or have you been paid specifically to get information out to the public for the public good for need-to-know purposes? If so, then you should be allowed in and credentialed as press. Paid platforms count. If it's happening openly in a public space, then credentialing should not and does not apply. And to be fair, Jonathan Cho, my understanding, is allowed at open space press conferences where the governor's going to be. You can't keep someone out of a public space. It's the press conferences at the governor's office. He's not being allowed to attend. Pat wrote, who decides who gets to be a journalist? That is deep. It surely shouldn't be the government. Who decides who gets to be a licensed doctor, attorney, massage therapist, contractor, and on and on and on? Is there a board that tests and certifies and reviews complaints about journalist practices and conduct? And I'm not talking about an association, but a board that can recall a journalist license. I don't like that either, because, again, you run into First Amendment issues, and there's so many different types of journalists that serve so many different types of audiences and purposes. Like, how would you license that? How would you license being a journalist? And should you really have to have a license to practice, you know, constitutionally protected speech? So, you know, as I said on the episode Wednesday, I don't really have a perfect answer. I tend to agree with that first comment that, you know, kind of a combination of that first comment and then what Alicia said, which is, you know, are you being paid specifically to get information out to the public? That's kind of the first litmus test. And then is there anything you've done that would, you know, disqualify you from being at one of these press conferences? Either your you know, past conduct at a press conference. I think a combination of those two things, like, sure, if Jonathan Cho's allowed at the governor's office and then it's a loose cannon of some kind, then, you know, maybe they can reevaluate. But I don't think that he would do that. I don't think that his behavior has shown anything but someone trying very hard to get answers to questions. And yes, sometimes reacting very forcefully when you have a politician that is stonewalling him. You know, like I said, Jonathan's behavior at previous press conferences, what did the King County executive expect when he wouldn't take Jonathan's questions? That he's just going to give up and be like, okay, then? No. You know, like, shout him at him. I might even have followed Dow Constantine until he went down a private elevator. Because if you're being stonewalled over and over and over, your tactics are going to have to change. All right, that's it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. And thank you for understanding that we had to push the Friday show to Sunday. If you have not become an Undivided subscriber already, help us grow this mission, grow this movement. You can do that in two ways, patreon.com/undivided, or you can become a contributor on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com.